I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce meeting to order. Today's Friday, April 5th. Time is 3:19 p.m. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Ashley Strauch, and thank Flanagan. It's not Flanagan. Flannery Ballard, our current House Labor and Commerce Secretary, and Sophia Tenney, the LIO moderator. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Tallarico, Representative Stutes, and my name, Chair Wool, and we have a quorum to conduct business. There's a few items on the agenda today. We'll start with the confirmation hearing for the Board of Nursing nominees, Marisha Dieters and Wendy Monrad. After that, we'll have our second hearing of HB 30 from Representative Josephson. The Speaker referred the following governor's appointment to the House Labor and Commerce Committee, Marisha Dieters and Wendy Monrad to the Board of Nursing. Members have received the appointees' applications. We'll begin with Marisha Dieters. And I hope I'm saying your name. Marisha, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi. You want to introduce yourself and make any statement if you have one prepared?
Sure. So my name is Marisha Dieters. I have applied for an appointment to the Board of Nursing for the RN position. I have a bachelor's from the University of Alaska that I graduated in 2011 and recently finished a master's from Frontier Nursing University, master's in nursing as a nurse practitioner. I currently work at the Alaska Native Medical Center, and I am a specialty nurse doing wound and ostomy care. I have past experience in a private outpatient clinic here in Anchorage, as well as a rural hospital in Bethel. And I applied to the Board of Nursing to support high-quality nursing care in Alaska.
Thank you. And thank you for applying for the board. Any questions from committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Dieters, there's been some communications about your qualifications, not because of your skills in nursing, but because of your advancement to being a nurse practitioner. Do you care to speak to that, whether you're still eligible to hold a position on the Board of Nursing as an RN seat?
Well, as a nurse practitioner, we are also required to maintain licensure as an RN in Alaska. That's part of the requirements for that. To be honest, I guess I don't know if it disqualifies me. When I initially applied for the position and talked to the executive administrator about it, she knew that I was about finished with this degree, and she didn't indicate that it would be a problem.
Follow up?
So just my understanding from nurses is they want to make sure that it's an RN doing RN work, holding the seat that represents RN on the board, and they are versus someone who is working as an advanced nurse practitioner, and I am not clear as to the difference in the skill set or the caste system that exists in nursing to be able to tell you why those differences would be there, but those issues have been raised. So perhaps you could speak to your ability to both hold the issues and viewpoints of an RN and not neglecting those, even if you've advanced your career to the level of being a nurse practitioner, which has a specified seat on the board also.
Yeah. I mean, I've been working as an RN in various different kind of areas of nursing for the last 8 years. I'm not working as an NP yet. I'm still currently an RN at the Native Hospital. I'm working in changing into that role. As far as the difference in our roles, nurse practitioners are allowed to diagnose, treat, write orders, which an RN is not allowed to do. I do, because I've done their job, or I've done the job of the RN, I understand the needs and limitations of that position, and I'm willing to represent RNs appropriately, even if I am now working as or going to be working as an NP. I recognize a difference in in both of those skill sets. But if certainly if it's a concern of the nurses in the state and somebody else feels like they would be better fit for the position, you know, that's, I understand that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stutes.
I guess my comments are more than comments than they are a question. It just seems to me you, in fact, as you stated, through the chair, excuse me.
No problem, Representative Stutes.
You are an RN, and to me this is the same thing as saying, well, I have my teaching certificate, but you can't teach because you have your doctorate of education. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it would seem to me you would be more of an advantage than a detriment having the additional education. So I find the complaints a little weightless.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hannah.
And this, I'll give the example of being a certified teacher. All principals must have teacher certification, but from the viewpoint of a teacher, when you become a principal, you have a different lens that you view those on. And I'm not sure with nursing if that's the concern that was raised of now that she's in a, she has more skills and will view it from a different viewpoint than those of us dressing the wounds and doing that primary care. That's what I personally, I am thrilled to see advanced nurse practitioners doing primary care across Alaska. So I wanted to give Ms. Dieters that opportunity to just sort of, because in the teaching world, I could clearly articulate where the difference lens would be.
Representative.
Yeah, and like I said, I understand that point of view from people who may think that this person is a nurse practitioner, she doesn't understand what RNs do anymore, maybe, you know, some sort of viewpoint like that. My rebuttal would be that I've been doing nursing for 8 years. I am a very fresh nurse practitioner. I haven't even started my first job yet. And I do the work of the RN right now, and I understand a lot of what they do. But at the same time, like I said, I do understand the viewpoint. And if somebody else feels that they are more qualified, I would encourage them to apply for the seat instead. But I would like to remain on the board despite the fact that I do have an advanced degree.
Representative Tallarico.
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to echo the sentiments of my colleague from Kodiak. Maybe I don't know enough about, I'm certainly not a nurse, but it seems like to me that maybe this even works to our advantage. That's it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues on the committee. I have heard a little bit on this issue, and at first glance, I had the same thought. Well, if someone has more qualifications, what's the problem? Ms. Dieters is a recent, has been an RN for most of her career and just only recently became a APRN or nurse practitioner. So I'm not questioning her ability to represent nurses. I have heard from other people in the profession, they're concerned that they want someone, quote unquote, in the more boots on the ground as opposed to a different job classification, similar to a principal and a teacher. And if someone's been a principal for 10 years, they're going to have a different outlook, even if they started out as a teacher. Now, if they just became a principal last month, then they're probably going to see things through teacher lenses. But after a few years, they may not. So I am sort of aware. And the makeup, Ms. Dieters, are you familiar with the makeup of the board as far as how many positions of each description?
There should be one advanced practice registered nurse, one educator, and we all are RNs or licensed nurses, so the APRN, the educator, two RNs, two public seats, an LPN. I feel like I'm missing one, but maybe not. I'd have to look it up.
Okay, that sounds about right. So I thank you for being upfront and saying if you don't feel that you meet the qualifications or you're overqualified or you don't exactly fit the description, that you'd be willing to step aside. I don't think there's anyone else appointed. So in fairness, I think I'm going to hold. I mean, we all have to pass these names out eventually, so I can't stop that from happening. But I think I do want to hear from someone that knows more than those of us on the committee, maybe someone, a board member or someone from the Nurses Association or something, just to hear a different perspective, because we're not in the profession. So I think it would be wise of us to maybe hear a couple other voices on this subject, if that's okay with you, and we will get back to you in the very near future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and I'd like to recognize Representative Brivac has joined us. Are there any questions from any committee member? Representative Hannon.
Can I ask Ms. Dieters a different question along a different lines?
Sure may.
I've asked most of the nursing candidates. There was an audit done last year by legislative audit about the Board of Nursing, and one of the points it was found the Board of Nursing a little negligent in and dinged them over was the ability to work with telemedicine delivery in Alaska. And perhaps with some new and current education, you could address how you might view how the Board of Nursing could help Alaskans deliver primary care via telemedicine across Alaska.
Yes, I can actually speak quite a bit to that. Like I said, I worked in a rural hospital. I worked in Bethel, and a lot of what we did out there was telemedicine. Of course, I did it from kind of watching as an RN. I couldn't really participate in a lot of that. One of my goals as an NP working at ANNC is trying to incorporate telemedicine into my own practice for lots of reasons. One is, nobody wants to travel from their home. Well, I would think people don't want to travel from their home all the way to Anchorage for a single appointment. Living in the rural Alaska, I personally had to do that where the doc said, oh, you were on a plane tonight to go into Anchorage. And, you know, I had things that I had to do and I didn't want to leave. And also what I hear, even though I haven't particularly researched it, is one of the biggest expenses to the state Medicaid program is travel, and if I can see people using a telemedicine or a telehealth platform and be able to see them in their hometown without having to pay for the travel, I think that would be beneficial on both sides. The patient doesn't have to leave their home, and the state doesn't have to pay for the travel unless it's truly necessary. I do know that the telemedicine in the rural areas was beneficial that way, where if people didn't need to be flying all over their region, then they didn't need to be doing that. So I am a supporter of telemedicine and telehealth, and I would like to see nurse practitioners doing more of that role. As far as how an RN would play in that role, I don't know that there's a huge role for the RN in that, because that is more of a primary care provider function.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any more questions from the committee? Seeing none. Marisha, so I think we will get back with you maybe at the next meeting. I don't know what our schedule is exactly, but in the very near future. Your resume certainly is impressive. The problem is it might be too impressive, but We'll get to the bottom of that issue here real soon. So thank you for calling in today, and thank you for being patient with us. And we will be in touch with you very soon.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Wendy Monrad.
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Hi, Wendy. You want to state your name and any prepared statement you have for the appointee to the Board of Nursing?
Yes, my name is Wendy Monrad. I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist, which is one of the four APRNs. I currently work at Alaska Native Medical Center. I have been there for approximately 12 years. I came to Alaska in 2002 with the Air Force and decided to stay here, like many. I am also currently back on active duty with the Public Health Service. and will be retiring from that organization in September, hoping to stay on full-time where I am right now and moving into half-time in the future. I'm excited for this opportunity to serve the state. I have served on my local Alaska Nurse Anesthetist Association in multiple positions, and also been involved with our national organization. I interacted quite a bit with the Board of Nursing over the last 5 to 7 years, presenting different projects, bringing follow-up data on those projects, and that's kind of where my interest grew with the Board of Nursing. I was also involved with the APRN Alliance in the drafting of revised nursing regulations for the SB 53 legislation that was passed in July of 2017, where we redid our regulations for the Board of Nursing. That was an interesting experience as well. So I'm honored to be considered for this position, and should I be confirmed, be fully committed to supporting and acting on this board in the best interest of the people of Alaska.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, wow. Well, I'll start. Maybe I'll get some more going here. You've had a lot of interactions with the Board of Nursing over the last several years, it says. What was your takeaway from dealing with the board over the last few years?
It was good. It was positive. We've had a lot of positive change at the Alaska Native Medical Center in practices, and brought some of those practices forward to improve our patient care there, and seeing the process of how the board regulates and approves new challenges and new things in practice for nursing was new for me. In 2014 was my first project, and so it was a good learning experience. I was impressed with the knowledge and the purpose of the board in protecting the public. And then with that particular project, I had to go back on 2 different occasions and bring data, showing the progress, and it was a positive interaction, and that's where my interest grew.
Thank you. Were you surprised when the board was sort of disbanded here recently, with the exception of, I believe, one member?
I will admit I was surprised by that. We had our first meeting 2 weeks ago, and I was really impressed with the leadership in the Board of Nursing, the office itself. Sarah Chambers came in and did training with us. I felt like it was very eye-opening and encouraging. I was really impressed with the group of people that have been assembled for this board. We got to know each other a little bit, and I'm excited to see where we're going. We're all a little bit nervous because the majority of us are new. I will say Jeff LaFleur did a great job leading us that day. That's the remaining member. He's the educator. And I felt like for the first meeting that it really went well. So I'm encouraged. Leading up to that, I was a little nervous.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm glad there's enthusiasm from the new members, and Representative Hanna looks like she has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. It sounds like if you're going to retire soon that you could be the one who takes a strong leadership role on the Board of Nursing. And I've asked all the prior candidates about an audit that legislative audit did of the Board of Nursing, and pointed to a couple of areas where they found some deficits. And one was the Board of Nursing's response and oversight of the 22, which surprised me, CNA instructional programs across the state, and making sure that agency review of them is done in a timely manner and they're kept current. And of course, I know that you as an advanced nurse practitioner, probably long ways from training with CNAs, but giving some insight in their ability to make sure we have that step in the healthcare delivery system functioning so that higher skilled nurses like yourself can do their jobs. The other area I've asked nurses who've been in the field, and you having experience with the board, is the nursing board's ability to respond to other deficits in functions to demonstrate some leadership for the industry. Could you speak to either of those?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am. We did talk quite a lot about the CNA program during that first meeting, and I have to be honest, that was my first introduction to that. I was never a CNA myself, and so I'm not familiar with that process, but we did talk quite a lot about it. We had multiple cases to review, and I have been a CRNA for almost 20 years, and I work in the operating room, and there are no CNAs in the operating room, so I've been away from the bedside nursing for quite a while. But in my past, in the Air Force, we had some CNAs that we worked with, and they're really a critical part of that team. And knowing that they can do the tasks that they've been assigned is incredibly important. So, you know, I see where that oversight definitely falls within this board's purview, and looking forward to learning more about that. It is a large number. Joan Green is the nurse consultant that they hired for the oversight of the program, and she did a fantastic job 2 weeks ago presenting a couple of different programs actually presented, and so, you know, in the little bit that I've gotten to know Joan, I think that, you know, we have a really qualified person in that role. I know that role went empty for a while, and there was no one able to do that oversight. It would be difficult for us, for sure. So she's a valuable part of that team. And then, ma'am, your second question, I'm sorry.
Boy, I don't even remember now. I think we look forward to having someone who's got the expertise in the field and maybe the opportunity to really give some time and energy to demonstrating some leadership on a board with 6 new members out of 7 needing that experience.
Thank you.
Ms.
Monrad, you mentioned SB 53 that's what got you involved in the board. Can you briefly summarize what that involved and what your role was in that? We don't all remember bills by memory.
Yes. Yes, sir. SB 53 was the APRN legislation where it pulled all of the advanced practice nurses together under the same title of advanced practice registered nurse versus NP for nurse practitioner, CRNA for certified registered nurse anesthetist, the certified nurse midwife, and the certified nurse specialist. So it pulled all four groups together under one title of APRN. And that's actually a national movement by the National Council for State Boards of Nursing. So many, many states are moving to that just to bring those professions together under one title, making it more clear and better to regulate for the state boards of nursing.
Thank you. I do remember
that. That bill went forward from, I believe, Senator Kathy Geisel was the proponent of that bill, and that passed, and then we rewrote our nursing regulations based on that.
Thank you. I do remember that bill now. We heard it in this committee previous years. Okay, well, I'm going to any further questions? Seeing none. I'm going to withhold passing both names on for right now. And this is no reflection of any future action, that's for sure. And we, as a committee, we can't hold your name, so we have to pass them on. I just wanted to get someone online to talk to us about the makeup of the board and the different seats, RN versus APRN, and what the perspective is on that. I won't put you on the spot by asking you that since you're brand new to the board anyways. So I will, I don't know that we need to hear back from you again, Wendy, but we will pass your name out of committee, but just not at this very moment. But don't take that as any sign of anything.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
No problem at all. And thanks for calling in today. And with that, we'll move on to our next item of business. Brief at ease. Back. Our next item of business today is HB 30, the Abigail Caudill Act. We do have a CS for that bill, and let me get to my section. My staff will present the CS, and then the bill sponsor will come up and handle the bulk of the bill. We just want to go over the changes that for the committee substitute. So Ashley, you want to introduce yourself and talk about the changes, only the changes to the bill.
For the record, Ashley Strauch, staff to Representative Wohl. HB 30, the CS in front of you, version S, makes two major deletions to the previous version. The first thing it does is that the benefit is no longer linked to the Consumer Price Index, or the CPI. And the second major change is there's no longer an option to file suit against an employer. Now, all that remains in the current bill is the death benefit monetary payout. And if there are any further questions, I would suggest asking the bill sponsor.
And can we have the bill sponsor up here? I don't know if we need to make, do we need to adopt the motion now? Okay. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I make a motion to adopt committee substitute for House Bill 30, version 31-LS0280/S.
Hearing no objection, the committee substitute version S is adopted before the committee is working document. Representative Josephson, you want to introduce yourself and your staff, and staff. Yourself.
Sure.
Proceed.
Yes. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17 in Anchorage.
For the record, Elise Swernberg, staff to Representative Josephson.
To remind, if I might, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
To remind the committee about this bill, I have this thing that should be before you. If not, I've got extra copies. But I can actually, I tested this, Mr. Chair, and I can explain this bill in 30 seconds. I actually timed this. The bill does three major things. It updates permanent partial impairment ratings for the whole body. Those haven't been adjusted since about 2000. So it updates those to reflect inflation. Essentially, the value of a lost limb or other significant damaged or damaged bodily dysfunction is updated spanning the last 19 years. The second thing it does is it updates a death benefit that hasn't been updated in 51 years, and that is for dependents who are not in a sort of nuclear family, but still dependent. And the third thing it does is it creates a new death benefit for single childless people. Those are the three major things it does. So two of the things it does, the first two I mentioned, are existing benefits that are just merely updated. The third thing it does is not an existing benefit. It does create a new benefit. I looked at the fiscal note from last year, and for example, for the state employees, and there's about 17,000, there was one person who was deceased at work and wasn't married and didn't have children. So you can see that fortunately not many people die at work, thank God, and this would be a rarely used benefit.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? And Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. I'm looking at the bill. Is there a death benefit for an individual if they should happen to have an injury that takes their life on the job, but they have no surviving heirs, no mother, father, brother, sister, child?
Through the chair, the answer is yes. In that event, the death benefit would go to the estate. Now, the estate may have to settle debts of the individual deceased person, but the estate would handle the death benefit.
To the chair, follow up.
Representative Stutes.
Is there an amount on that?
Yes, it is 120 or 130,000.
So that would be the same as what would go to a surviving parent or parents. So it is a 120,000.
Hello?
How did you determine that number?
Through the chair, two ways. The first is, in our research to see what other states did, we found that the most generous state was the state of Louisiana, and it paid around $120,000. Now, if my recollection's right, it may actually pay more because it's possible that goes to each parent. But essentially, it was in the range of $120,000. The second reason is, when we updated the benefit from 1968 that hasn't been touched for 51 years, we found that if you applied inflation to that old benefit, which is just a mere $20,000 now, it would make it $150,000. And it would be sort of illogical to eclipse that number because in those situations there were actual dependents.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Jefferson, you're the CS meet your approval, I assume.
It does.
And just to recap, the we're updating the amounts.
Yes.
We're allowing a childless, if someone would be childless, without dependents, the benefits would go to their parents if alive.
Correct.
That's a change.
It's a change.
And the third thing is, if they're childless and parentless, it would go to the estate.
Correct.
Is there another change that I'm missing?
There is one change at the very, very end of the bill. So there is one other feature. It's not the principal feature of the bill, but if a person loses a parent at work and they have no other surviving parent, and they're, let's say, approaching 18 years old, under the current law, there would be no benefit at all. In other words, if you were a 17-year-old, an 11-month-old high school senior, and you lived with your father, and you went to school that day, and he went to work and died there, you could not enjoy anything more than 1 month of a spendable weekly wage according to the calculation benefit. Nothing. And you couldn't sue because that's it. That's the workers' comp benefit. And we've extended that 5 years. So effectively, that young man would get some workers' comp benefit through age 23.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that on top of the death benefit?
No. Through the chair, no.
Oh, Representative Hannon.
Through the chair, why wouldn't we just give them what we were giving the estate, $120,000? Because I presume, or is 5 years of workers' comp going to exceed $120,000? Maybe that's my question.
Through the chair, that's a good question. And I think that 5 years, I'd have to look at those numbers carefully to see, and I'd be happy to do that. As I sit here right now, I think I'd be guessing.
Follow up.
And would that 5 years of weekly average earnings of 5 years be paid out in a lump sum or over 5 years?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that is paid out over the course of those years, and that is basically just taking existing worker comp benefits that you would receive as a child and extending what already exists in law 5 years.
In other words, if I might follow up, in other words, if this one provision at the end of the bill had not passed, was not part of the bill, that 17-year-old and 11-month-old young man or woman would receive something for 30 days, and then it would cease. And if there had been something that was unfairly negligent, that is, this wasn't a pure accident, no one meant to hurt Dad, but boy, they could have done better by Dad to protect him, there'd be no remedy. They recall that. There'd be no way to sue and seek anything further. So this is designed to, essentially, I looked at this and said, and found that troublesome.
So if the child was 13, under current law, he'd get the benefit up until he was 18 of a monthly workers' comp benefit, or would they also get the death benefit because he's a dependent? Or because they're under 18, they wouldn't get the death benefit? Does that make sense? I asked a lot of questions in there.
Hold on one moment, if I might.
Through the chair, we might have to look into that to get an answer that's adequate.
Okay, I guess my question is, we're talking about a death benefit for dependents. Mm-hmm. If the dependent is a minor, and let's say it's $120,000, does the minor get the $120,000, or is there another set of benefits that kicks in, which seemed to be what you implied earlier?
Mr. Chair, I think I see the answer. So essentially, current law lays out, for example, it has a formula that we're not adjusting in the slightest way. And it says, for example, if there's a widow or widower or child or children, the following percentages apply. And it says 80% for the widow or widower with no children of the spendable weekly wage. So you're just married, for example, to a woman, you didn't have children. You'd get the wife, the widow would get 80%. And then it goes on like that, 50% for the widow where there's one child and 40% for the child, totaling 90%. And you can sort of see that it's very formulaic. But here, I believe, is the answer to your question. It says the remedy or the award, it's not really an award, would be 100% for an only child where there is no widow or widower. So this would be a situation where I'm thinking of the show Courtship of Eddie's Father. There's no mother. There's just Eddie and his father. His father passes away. Eddie would get the 100% of the spendable weekly wage. Now, would Eddie also get a death benefit? No. Young Eddie would just get the spendable weekly wage. I think I have that right.
Okay. And Representative Stutes has a question, but I just want to. So if a widow is getting a percentage of wage, when do they get the death benefit? And when do they get the percentage of wage?
So, through to the chair, the death benefit in current law only applies for this category from 1968. It's this $20,000 1968 law. And it says, for example, if you're taking care of your mother, so she's not in your nuclear family because you're a mature man of over, say, you're 30. And you die, and your mother was relying on you, she will get $20,000. And today in 2019, she'd still just get $20,000. And so what we're saying is, if the legislature was right in 1968, then we need to be right now, and we need to update that. The only other death benefit is the one that we're creating for a single childless person. And the reason there aren't other death benefits is because where there's all these survivors in a nuclear family, they get the benefit of a spendable weekly wage.
Okay, I think I got it. Thank you. And the only other thing, you extend from 18 to 23, so someone who's will get that benefit past the age of 18 until, say, they're out of college age.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to also say that we asked the department, our alleged legal team, to look at what I reported a couple weeks ago. And what I reported a couple weeks ago is that the benefits that might pay over a span of a long time with a widow and several young kids were, the number I used was $850,000. turns out I was right, but it can actually eclipse just over $1 million. So I don't want the committee to think, wow, you know, where there's actually a nuclear family that needs caring for, they don't get a death benefit. They're getting, in some instances, upwards of $1 million spanning over many years.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for my own clarification then, so you have, we're going to say, a one-child family, mom, the dad, the child. The dad is killed in an on-the-job injury. The kid, does the kid get the benefit, the monthly, for 5 years, as well as the mother getting the death penalty, death payout? I mean, are they simultaneous, or is it one or the other? Or is it, if there's a mother that's alive, she gets the death benefits and the dad's, or in the kid's SOL?
Through the chair, those benefits would run essentially concurrently. And so by that, what I mean is it would be as if the child hadn't reached 18. So, I mean, obviously they had, but it would be as if they were 13 when they... Nothing changes. It's just they get the benefit for, in your illustration, a widow and a single child, but it just keeps going beyond 18 to 23. So the formula for... can you come back to the bill?
Representative Josephson, I guess my question is, are the both individuals receiving benefits, or if there is a mother, does just the mother receive the benefits, or the wife? It would be just the wife. Or do both the wife and the child that's under 18 receive benefits?
Through the chair, I think I see where Representative Stutes is going. The way it is in current law, the law says this child gets a benefit, but I don't think there's really a check that's written to the child. In other words, I think it's assumed that mom would manage the spendable weekly share that the child is receiving. Now, what would happen if the child was 18? Should mom still be managing the spendable weekly wage? The bill that you've just adopted doesn't answer that. And it's an interesting question, because at some point, I'm not sure you'd want mom controlling the 19 or 20 or 21-year-old person's portion of what should be a shared spendable weekly wage. I think I see the point.
Follow up?
That's kind of where I'm going, is if it's a mother and a son that both get benefits and the son is under 18, but he's 17 and a half, so for the next 4.5 years, is mom taking care of his dough?
Through the chair, it's an interesting question, and I'm pretty sure that my bill doesn't speak to it. In other words,
if I may, Representative Justin, I, having had some experience with some of these kind of benefits, I think at the age of 18, I'm only guessing, and there's no one on the lifeline, so we can get back to that, but I think at the age of 18, the check would come to the no longer child, but a legal adult, and I don't think the mother would control the funds of the child over 18.
That sounds logical to me.
We can call Lifeline later. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's simply an extension of a current law, right? Our current death benefits, if you started out with the widow and the child. Mm-hmm. So would the director of workers' comp, who I happen to see in the audience, be able to address what the current practice is with that? Or does it, right now, it stops the day the child turns 18?
Through the chair, it stops, and so I don't know that there is a current practice.
So we haven't had a current practice of a legal adult, age 18 and one, who now has full legal autonomy to their own finances.
Through the chair, I think that's probably right, although there may be a circumstance where a 17-year-old said, hey, Mom, I read the law, and where's my 40% or 70%? I want to go, you know, to college, and I want it for that, dedicated for that. I don't know.
I want to buy a truck. That's 17-year-old. But yeah. No, you're very mature. 17-year-old did say that. Yeah.
seeing as we're in gray area right now, I think we'll maybe stop this.
Okay. But if I could, Mr. Yes. Chair, I do want to remind folks, because there is a tendency with this bill for people to, because I think it's an interesting bill for people to ask a lot of questions. And I just want to remind folks that it really is a simple bill in that it takes permanent partial impairment and just says we need to update the whole body number for the year 2000. We need to take this death benefit from 1968 and update that benefit. You're just changing numbers. It's all you're doing. And then it creates this new death benefit for childless unmarried people. Those are the main things. Now, we've spent a fair amount of time talking about this other element that extends the spendable weekly wage for someone who it would have expired for on their 18th birthday to their 23rd birthday.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any comments from the committee? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. Well, and Representative Josephson, I'm wondering if maybe that could be a problem, and that's why I bring it up. If maybe you could clarify that upon turning 18, then that individual, the checks would go, you know, I'm just thinking kind of down the road to prevent a family feud, so to speak. And, you know, money usually is the root of all evils is what they say. And so that's, thank you. That's why I was bringing it up.
And just very briefly, Mr. Chair, relative to family feuds, that actually came up and the bill was adjusted last year in circumstances where you had two parents who were no longer together. So two surviving parents, the bill addressed that issue. What Representative Stutes is talking about is a sort of a similar variation of that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you. I would like to encourage you to resolve our questions because I'd like to support this bill, and I think having workers' compensation benefits that meet the 21st century, not just the year 2000, the 21st century reality of the circumstance of many of our workers may not live in a household with the legal benefit of spousal definition under the law. And a 1968 level benefit is far outdated. And I'm glad that it is a rarely applied benefit, but we need to make sure that the loophole that you became aware of if you don't have a legal spouse or a dependent child, there is no benefit, is shameful. And I'd like to see us remedy that and bring it into an adequate amount of compensation and make sure we are truly resolving a problem. Because families today and households today look demographically very different than they did in 1968.
Thank you.
Any further comments or questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, we will hold this bill. We're going to have an amendment deadline for this coming Monday at noon in the co-chair's office. We will get back to this bill, resolve these issues.
Thank you.
And I believe that concludes our business for today. We will gavel out. It is now 4:08 p.m.